one of the few vivid days I remember growing up transpired kind of like this. Now, some of you don't know this. When I was a kid, we didn't have iPads and phones and all of those things. And we were a one TV house. And so the one TV house had a remote control with a string. I don't know if anybody has ever seen a remote control with a string that is under the age of 40 tied to the TV. And that was controlled by my father, who lived in the recliner. And as soon as he got home, he was the boss over the recliner. And the three of us sat on the floor, my brother, sister, and I. And as children often do, they would get into it. And I remember my sister and I, and if you've ever been around me when my sister is around, you know we still, even at our ripe old age in our 50s now, we still fuss. And I was fussing at her, and she was fussing at me, and I was poking, and she was poking, and then she was punching, and I was taking it, and we were going through all of this stuff, and this commercial came on. And I don't think I've ever seen this commercial again since this point, but some of you might remember it. It is a lady who is exhausted, and her words are, "Calgon, take me away." You've seen, if you're over my age, you've seen that commercial. And I just remember my mother in her old wooden rocking chair saying, "That's what I need, not you two." She needed a break. She needed a break from brother or from her children that were at each other's throats all of the time, it seemed. She needed just some time alone. And she would have taken it any way she could. Reminds me a little bit of this text. Let's read it together. Immediately, Jesus made his disciples get into the boat and go before him to the other side, to Bethsaida, while he dismissed the crowd. So this is right after he fed them, and there's a whole bunch of people there. And after he had taken leave of them, he went up to the mountain to pray. And when evening came, the boat was out on the sea, and he was alone on the land. And he saw that they were making headway painfully, for the wind was against them. And about the fourth watch of the night, he came to them, walking on the sea. He meant to pass by them. But when they saw him walking on the sea, they thought it was a ghost and cried out, for they all saw him and were terrified. But immediately he spoke to them and said, "Take heart, it is I. Do not be afraid." And he got into the boat with them, and the wind ceased, and they were utterly astounded, for they did not understand about the loaves, and their hearts were hardened. Okay, I've been thinking about this story for about the last month, getting ready for this sermon, and I find this to be one of the more important stories that we need to tell and maybe retell from the perspective of Jesus and the disciples. So you get this interesting story, and Bryce has already kind of broken down some of it for you, but you get this story of Jesus on the water, and we know the walking part, but maybe we forget about the part that comes before that. And in the context of this story, you have got an exhausted group of disciples. Okay, here's why they're exhausted. In the morning, they have found out that John the Baptist has died. So this one who some of them knew and some of them interacted with and probably all of them knew about, they have now had the story come to them that John the Baptist has died. And so they're in the middle of probably processing that when all these people start to show up. And when I say all these people, I don't mean 10 or 12. Bible says 5,000 plus show up. That 5,000 men, which I assume then is 5,000 men and all of their families that come with them, are now following this fellow named Jesus, wanting to see and hear and maybe experience the miraculous. And so in the midst of this, they're going from this state of grief to now this state of ministry. And Jesus basically says, "Let's feed them." And you can imagine their response. Their response seems to be, and my guess is it kind of came out like this, "You got to be kidding me. I mean, look around. Look at all of these people. There are thousands of them." But Jesus, as Jesus always does, has got a plan. And so for the rest of that day, because you don't feed 5,000 people plus their families in 35 seconds. So through the rest of the day, they're feeding. And you can imagine the ministry that was going on between Jesus and the rest of the disciples. And so we get to the end of that, and Jesus says, "You head that way." And I'm assuming what he means is, "You head that way, and I will meet you there soon." But he sends them without him. And I've wrestled with that. I've wrestled with, why doesn't Jesus jump in the boat? And I know he's going to go off to himself to pray, but is he giving the disciples time to process what they've done? I mean, if you have ever had days like this where you've had incredible grief or incredible ministry, you know both of those things can be exhausting. And maybe at the end of that, what Jesus is doing is not only setting himself up to pray with his Father, but giving them the time as a group to process what they've seen. And so he sends them on the way. And then Mark says, Jesus intended to walk by. Now, when the gospel writers tell this story, only Mark includes that little line that Jesus intended just to walk on by, but you get this weird exclamation. They say it's a ghost. Now, what's weird about this story is you've got at least four on this boat that are experienced fishermen. You've got four on this boat that know the Sea of Galilee like the back of their hand, because they've been working it since they were probably kids. But yet this figure, and maybe if we don't put ourselves in that situation, we can't fully understand it, but this figure starts walking by as the winds and the waves are crashing against them, and they think, that isn't right. And my guess is we would say the same thing. And so their only explanation is, it must be a ghost, it must be some appearing of something. And so they kind of freak out, and they're nervous, and they're scared. And when you're scared, fears set in. And let's just be honest, sometimes life is scary. Sometimes we go through this life and maybe we've had successful ministry, or maybe we've been brokenhearted by grief, but we're trying to process all of that, and we get out somewhere and those fears start to come. And before we know it, we can be balled up in just those fears. Okay, for those who don't know, if you've never been alone in this building late at night, you're missing out. Let me just say that. So call me sometime, and I'll let you in about 7 o'clock when it's pitch dark outside, and then I'll leave you, and you tell me what you think about an hour later. Because everything creaks, and the wood, and the beams, and the bricks don't creak, but it seems like even the bricks make a sound. And there are some Fridays that I work a little bit later, and it's already dark outside, and you know me, I'm kind of a little bit of a scaredy cat. And I lock all the doors to the office, and I check all the doors to the building, and then I go back and I lock myself not only in the office complex, but then I lock myself in my little tiny office and I turn down most of the lights because I'm a little nervous. Fear sets in and your mind races. And my guess is you've got these 12 that are sitting on the boat, and even though almost half of them are experienced fishermen, fear sets in, and even the experienced lake goer still knows trouble might come, and then in walks a ghost. And they freak out. So what's the remedy? There was a neat, I don't know if you watch, I find TED Talks to be one of the coolest things to watch. I don't always agree with them, but there was a lady named Michelle Poehler who did a TED Talk, and here's this lady, and it was about 100 days without fear. And if you go and listen to her TED Talk, she talks about how she's kind of like me. She's a scaredy cat, and everything she sees on TV and everything her friends are doing and everything that is going on around her, she says, I wouldn't do that. I'm too scared. And so she decides that at this point she's going to spend the next 100 days conquering her fear. Now, she does it smart. So one of her fears is spiders. And so she goes to the zoo and asks the zookeeper, I want you to bring out the scariest non-poisonous spider you got. And so the zookeeper brings out the scariest looking non-poisonous snake or spider she's got and puts it in this lady's hand. And she looks at it and she says, I'm okay. And then she goes on and for 100 days faces her greatest fears. And then on the 100th day, she decides she's going to make a public speech. And she goes to a little civic group in her town and wants to talk about what she does for a living. And she goes before that group and gives her first talk in front of bodies. And then she writes this essay, How to Handle Your Fears. And what's interesting is her essay says, handling fear is all about trust. Now, doesn't that make sense? It's all about trust. That in the middle of our most fearful days, in the middle of those moments when we don't know what's coming and going, that we've got to find this place to trust. Here's what David says. He says in Psalm 25, "To you, O Lord, I lift up my soul. O my God, I trust in you." Okay, I've started doing this. Anytime I see or hear somebody say, "Oh my God," which is not one of my favorite phrases the world uses, I say quietly and maybe even sometimes out loud, "I trust in you." Because that's what David is saying. David is in the midst of opposition, and David is in the midst of trial. And in the midst of that, he's looking to God saying, "Here's where I'm going to put my trust." Matthew 14 reads like this, "But immediately Jesus spoke to them." Okay, same telling of the story of the boat. "Take heart, it is I. Do not be afraid." So in the middle of those moments where fear sets in, we need to trust the one who's in charge of the water. We need to trust the one who created us. We need to trust the voice that we need to hear. What I find so intriguing in this story is the minute the disciples hear the voice, it makes all the difference in the world. The minute they hear the voice of Jesus. See, my problem is that sometimes when the wind and the waves are battering and my life is going sideways and I'm nervous or I'm anxious or I'm fearful or fill in whatever other words go with that, that I don't take quite enough time to hear the voice. That I don't take quite enough time to hear Scripture say over and over, "In you, Lord, I put my trust." That I don't have enough time to think about what's important from God and the Son to me. And my guess is you may have that same problem too. That there may be times in your life when everything is going sideways and the world starts to go a little bit crazy. And I think this story can help us. Because I think when my world is going a little bit crazy, I need to hear a few things from this story. And the first thing I need to hear is it's okay to dismiss the crowd. Remember, leading into this story, Jesus has got the 5,000 plus family. So I'm guessing you've got 10,000 people sitting in this little hollow, and they've all had sandwiches and lunch and fish and bread and all of that stuff. And there comes a point in time where Jesus says, "We've got to stop." I believe everybody needs to sometimes say, "It's got to stop." That there's got to be a break. There's got to be a moment. There's got to be a take me away kind of moment where we go off somewhere else to be with God. And I know that's easier said than done, but I also know from experience that when we just go and go and go and never take time to dismiss the crowd and be with God, we create a monster that needs to be taken care of. Remember, they're in the midst of grief, and they're in the midst of ministry, and even life itself is exhausting. And Jesus says, "Let's take some time. I'm going." And then the second thing is we've got to go to the mountain to pray. Okay, sometimes we need to speak, and possibly sometimes we even need to yell. And there's a lot of the time that we just need to listen. And that only happens when we go to the mountain. Now, I'm not speaking literally, although some, that's one of the things they do. They'll take on their day off and they'll go to the mountains and they'll hike and they'll walk and they may talk with God and they may yell with God and they may cry with God, but they find a place where they can do those things. Okay, quite possibly my favorite ministry story in the Old Testament comes from 1 Kings 19, and it is kind of one of the final stories about Elisha, and I encourage you to go read that story on your own. It's a pretty short chapter, but the story kind of goes like this. 18 is the great story of Carmel. Remember, that's where Jesus wasn't there yet, or at least not in that sense. Elijah is out there battling the other prophets and guys of Baal and Asherah there on Mount Carmel, and there's this great victory, and Elisha comes down from that, and it's triumphant, and rain is going to come, and he kind of runs by the chariot, and that's the kind of the end of chapter 18. And then chapter 19 begins with this wicked queen named Jezebel, and nobody names their daughters Jezebel anymore, and you've got this wicked queen named Jezebel who says to Elijah, "You better get out of here because I'm after you." And Elijah knows that this threat is real. And so Elijah starts to hide. And in the midst of his hiding, he has two dreams and two different times where God says to him, arise and eat because the journey's going to be hard. And he does that the first night. And then he does it again the second night. And then Elijah throws this tantrum. And he says, God, where are you in the midst of this? And I'm the only one doing this, and I'm the only one. And he does kind of like what we do sometimes. And what's interesting is God doesn't get on Elijah's case. Instead, God does something kind of strange. And so the wind blows. And I think when the wind blows, it's not a gentle breeze. The wind is howling. And the Lord's not in the wind. And then there's going to be an earthquake, and God's not going to be in the earthquake either. And then there's going to be a fire, and God's not in the fire. And finally, there is this gentle whisper, and that's where God is. And then Elijah, once realizing that now God is in his presence, or better yet, he's in the presence of God, he starts the tantrum all over again. I'm the only one left, and I'm the only one doing this, and everything is going sideways. And God says, here's what I got. And what Elijah needs to do is Elijah needs to listen to the voice. Because God says, I got a king who's coming to replace this king. And I got another king who's coming to replace Israel. And I got another king who's coming to replace Syria. And I got another prophet that's coming to replace you. And it's going to be all right. And not just that, but there are thousands who agree with you and not with the pagans. And Elijah only gets that when he goes to the mountain. Elijah only gets that when he's willing to spend some time and quietly listen and maybe quit the complaining and the temper tantrum and listen to what God has to say. And I think the same needs to be true for us. There has got to be those moments in our life when we're frustrated and we're angry and things aren't going the way we had planned for them to go, that we just sit quietly, and it's probably okay to throw the temper tantrum, but after we've thrown it, to sit quietly and listen to what God has to say. Last time we were in Brazil, the elders and the mission committee said, okay, the Pruitts, they work really hard and they're under a lot of stress. We want you to get them out of Recife and somewhere else. And so Nikki and I get there and we start doing a little research and we start asking a few questions, and we find that there's this little coastal village that's about an hour and a half outside of Recife. And we find that there's this little set of houses on there that you can rent. And so doing exactly as the elders and the mission committee asked us to, we convince the Pruitts, both Mike and R&E, and then Josh and Livia, to go to this little place with us because they needed a break. Because ministry is hard, and ministry in a third world is even harder. And so they're facing all of that pressure every day, and you can just see in their eyes they're exhausted and they're tired. And we go to this little place, and I've got a picture. They have all of these little hammocks. Maybe we have a picture. We don't have a picture. Okay, so imagine Mike Pruitt and I just sitting on hammocks. And in the midst of that, there was time to listen to God. In the midst of those moments, when ministry could kind of be put to the side, and even family could kind of be put to side for a second, there were just those moments to think and to pray and to dream. And we all left that place for, I don't even know if we were there 48 hours, but we all left that place, especially the Pruitts, energized, recharged, and ready to go. We need that. Okay, you need that. If you're a young mom and you're dealing with one or two or three or eight kids all at the same time, and they're pushing every button you've got, you need a moment. You need a time when you can say, I've got to get back with God. And maybe it's on your walk, or maybe it's wherever you fill in that blank. But we all need that. Maybe you've got a high-stress job that's constantly demanding and demanding and demanding, and it seems like you're working 8 and 10 and 12 hours a day. You need a time to find a mountain and just exhale. And I think all of us need that. But then the third thing I think we learn from this story is we need to trust in lessons learned. Okay, the haunting line to this story is this one that appears in verse 52. For they did not understand about the loaves, but their hearts were hardened. Okay, they had just watched Jesus take a kid's lunch and go from a kid's lunch to feeding, I don't know, 10,000 people. And yet they don't get it. And yet they don't understand who is in their presence, and they don't understand the power of Jesus. And sometimes we can be pretty hard on those disciples and say, how come they can't figure it out? But are we any different? Are there still those moments in our lives when the waves crash and things seem to go sideways, and we say, as Bryce said, we'll try to do it on our own power, that we think, I got this, and I can take care of it, and I can fix it, and I can solve the problem? And in a sense, when we have that attitude, we're just like the disciples. We're not getting the one who's in the boat with us. And I think we need to realize that. The other day, I was visiting with someone who doesn't come to church. And they said, man, God has really let me down. Now, anytime somebody says that, I want to try to have a teachable moment. And I said, well tell me, how has God let you down? And they say, well, I was into this, and he didn't bail me out. And my child was into this, and he didn't bail my child out. And this happened, and this happened, and this happened. And they were looking at all the circumstances of their life and blaming God for not fixing it. And so we had some conversation, and we talked a little bit, and we hopefully made some progress. But I got in the car and drove off, started thinking about God's track record. And I was thinking, does she have a point? I mean, are there moments in my life when God hasn't done what I needed him to do? Are there moments when God just lets something slide right on by and it had disastrous effects? And the more I thought about it, the more I thought, certainly there were those moments, but if I saw it from a bigger picture, God's track record was spotless. Now, I could nitpick and say, well, God didn't get me out of this here, but that might have been my own fault, and God didn't get so-and-so out of this, and that might have been their own fault, and God might have had an avenue for them to get out of all those things, and they didn't choose it. But yet, when I step back and see the whole forest instead of just the tree, God's track record's pretty good, and I need to trust in that. In the midst of grief, in the midst of ministry, in the midst of waves that are going sideways, I need to trust that God has got this. And I don't always. And my guess is you struggle with that some too. Hardest working minister in the Old Testament is a fellow by the name of Jeremiah. He preaches and lectures and tries to convict for decades. Not 5 years, 10 years, 25 years. For decades. And he doesn't get one single convert. Not one single person stands up and says, you know what, Jeremiah? You're right. But in the midst of that, there is this narrative of his call from Jeremiah 1. And God says, do not be afraid of them, for I am with you to deliver you, declares the Lord. It's almost like Jeremiah knows what he's fighting against. He knows where Judah is right now, and they are in chaos, and they are a mess. And he knows that there's not a whole lot of hope, and they're about to go into captivity. But God says to him, here you go, here's your job. Know this, I'm going to deliver. So do not be afraid. Okay, there's a man in this room that I look up to immensely who has no fears. He has no concern about what's going to happen tomorrow. He has no concern if he's in the middle of a health crisis, if he's going to live for 10 more years, or if he's got a week left. That he can be facing surgery and he can lay in that thing and I can come in and pray over him and say, God, take care of my friend. And he says he will one way or the other. And he's confident, and he's unafraid. And he meets every single day, not fearful of what will happen, but every single day with God is with him. And I want to live that way, because I don't always. I'm better at it now than I was 5 years ago, and I'm certainly better at it than I was 20 years ago. But I want to live each day like I know beyond a shadow of a doubt that God is with me. And I want you to live every day like God is with you. one of our parents was telling a story, probably about a year ago. They were in the corn maze at dusk, and I don't know if there's anything creepier than our building other than maybe a corn maze at dusk. And they're walking through the corn maze. It's Halloween, and it's dusk, and so it's starting to get dark. And the kid starts to get just a little bit nervous. And the dad, who's one of the best dads in our church, says, "Hold my hand, I'm here." And they get out of the corn maze. He didn't throw another fit the rest of the time. All dad had to say was, "Hold my hand, I'm here." I think that's what God says to us. Hold my hand, I'm here, let's go. Maybe you're nervous, maybe you're fearful, maybe you're anxious, maybe you're in the boat on the waves. Everybody in this room has been there. And I think we can help each other and remind each other to hold the hand of the Creator of the world. Maybe you just need elders' prayer or my prayer or someone next to you, their prayer. Find us, find someone you know, find someone you love, and ask them to pray over you. Maybe you're ready to start a new journey that says, "I'm going to fully trust in the only thing that is trustworthy." Then put that trust in God today and be baptized, and we'll celebrate that. But if you need us, let us know as Wayne leads our song. Let's stand together.